Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. The redistricting fight continues after the U.S. Supreme Court threw out Wisconsin's legislative maps drawn by Governor Tony Evers. We break down how this could impact future elections. Plus, a top Republican says he may withdraw subpoenas that have been the center of legal fights in Michael Gableman's election investigation. And Milwaukee leaders made their final pitch in D.C. in hopes to host the Republican National Convention. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for March 25th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm Jesse O'Poyan.
Jesse, thank you so much for joining us this week on Rewind. We have a lot to unpack, of course.
It's been a busy week.
We thought, you know, the legislative session, of course, came to an end, but the news doesn't stop in politics.
Especially in Wisconsin.
The big news this week, of course, was the redistricting battle. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled to throw out Wisconsin's legislative maps that were drawn by Governor Tony Evers. One important note, they did keep in place his congressional maps, so those will stay in place. Now, this decision means that the Wisconsin Supreme Court will now have to revisit the case to determine the new district lines. Now, I want to read just a section of the court's decision, which was kind of a shadow docket. So there wasn't an official ruling, but they gave us, I guess, some little tidbits. They said, on remand, the court is free to take additional evidence if it refers to reconsider the governor's maps rather than choose from among the other submissions. So I think just within a couple of matters, the governor's office was trying to figure out their next move, and now we know. They're asking the state Supreme Court to swiftly pass new maps, and they want the justices to allow them to submit new maps to reduce the Black Hispanic districts from 7 to 6. That was the main, disagreement with the court. They didn't like kind of the makeup of the Evers maps. I want to get into some of the reactions, and then we'll kind of break down what this means. So we had Rick Essenberg, the president of Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, of course, celebrating this ruling. This is a big victory for Republicans. They said the U.S. Supreme Court affirmed that Evers' legislative maps violate the equal protection guarantees of the U.S. Constitution by racially, what he says, gerrymandering districts in the Milwaukee area. Evers' statement shortly after the ruling said he says, you know, our maps are far better than Republicans' gerrymanderers' maps that they have right now that he vetoed last year. Let's hear a little bit from Attorney General Josh Call. He quickly responded to this when he was in a Wisconsin policy, or he was being interviewed on a whole matter of things, but let's take a listen, then we'll dive into this.
I think it's pretty shocking to see this ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think it's frankly consistent with the increasing activism we've seen from the conservative supermajority on the U.S. Supreme Court. So now there's going to have to be a new process in place. We're already past the date when the Election Commission had asked to have maps settled. And so this is going to create some real complications for our election process. And I think what we're going to see is a flurry of court action coming out of this regarding what the next round of maps will look like.
So, Jesse, this ruling comes 3 weeks after the state Supreme Court kind of gave Governor Evers a victory. Now we're kind of in this messy confusion stage because candidates are also trying to gather signatures. They want to get their name on the ballot, but they don't know what their district lines will look like.
It's a little bit of a complication, to say the least. Yeah, we've got less than a month until candidates can go out and start collecting signatures. They have to have those turned in and register their candidacy by June 1st, and it's really hard to get signatures when you don't even know which voters are going to be in your district. You know, some candidates probably have a little bit more of a sure hold on that than others, but you know, there are some that are really up in the air. And as you mentioned earlier, it comes down a lot to those assembly districts, the majority-minority districts. Currently, we've got 6. The Evers maps would make 7. Some of the Republican maps would make 5. So a lot of things could change based on how that plays out.
And I think the big lingering question now is what will swing justice Brian Hagendorf will do, because he ruled with liberal justices when they made a decision 3 weeks ago saying we like Evers' maps, but then the nation's high court, of course, stepped in. So I guess we just don't know, right? And what do you think is going to be this deadline now? Because Evers is asking the court to act swiftly because of this whole issue of candidates trying to file nomination papers.
Yeah, I mean, I think they have to do it quickly, and they've shown that they can rule quickly in the past on any number of things. So I think they recognize the interest here and the need to get things done quickly, but there are just a few things that they have to juggle. I mean, the state Supreme Court set the standard of the least change, so they're looking for maps that make the least change to the ones that we have right now. But federally, they have to comply with the Voting Rights Act, and they have to comply with the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment. And so if they can find a way to do that with the existing maps that they have, we might not see a whole lot of changes. But, you know, if new maps get introduced and considered, it might take a little bit longer.
And it will give Republicans kind of another shot, right? They didn't really, of course, like how the state's court ruled 4-3 last time, but now they can get another opportunity, in a sense, to try to claim victory in this whole redistricting battle, where Evers thought just a few weeks ago that, great, they chose mine, maybe I can go on the campaign trail and start, you know, bragging about this, that they picked my maps. But now Republicans are going to be fighting for that same type of victory lap.
Exactly. And also, at the end of the day, because of that least change principle, any victory for either side is a pretty small victory here.
Yeah, definitely. also this week, we had kind of an update on Gabelman's investigation, but not from Gabelman himself. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss was on a Wausau radio show, and he basically said that he may withdraw subpoenas that he's approved from Michael Gabelman's election investigation. This was first reported by the Journal Sentinel, and he didn't really say what his next move would be, but he kind of suggested that abandoning these subpoenas could result ultimately in some election officials being prosecuted for crimes. That's because these subpoenas that are issued by the legislature grants immunity to election officials, so they can't be prosecuted. So if those are taken away, maybe that's the next move. I want to read some quotes and reaction from Ann Jacobs, who is the WEC chairwoman. And she said, "The criminalization of election administration is a terrible thing to be accusing people of, and it's going to not lead to more effective elections administration." Here was the quote from Voss on WSAWAM radio. He said, "I'm seriously considering pulling back the subpoenas because it makes no sense to give people immunity now that we see there is so much that has been found by the found that if a Republican attorney could later prosecute." So I guess this maybe suggests, could Gabelman's investigation near an end?
Well, we've been wondering that for months now,
yeah.
Right? But, you know, this is not a bad way to at least put it on pause for Robin Voss, because you can kind of send it into the future, kick the can down to the next election, electing a Republican attorney general and moving this into the criminal realm rather than the legislative realm, where, you know, he doesn't have to worry about it as much anymore. You know, once it gets out of the legislature, it's in the hands of prosecutors. And I think that's been brought up several times throughout, you know, the hearings that we've seen and the questioning that we've seen of, you know, if there was this kind of fraud, what is the legislature really supposed to do about it? And why not refer it for criminal prosecution? And again, you know, as we've noted before, there hasn't been evidence of widespread fraud. But if that does exist, isn't that better served by a criminal prosecution?
And we've already seen three district attorneys already decline to prosecute members from the Wisconsin Elections Commission. That was DAs in Racine, Milwaukee, and Green Lake. So, you know, it's once again, here's Voss in this tough spot trying to appease both sides who firmly believe, you know, want decertification, think there was widespread fraud, but others who just want to move on and focus towards November and trying to win up and down the ballot. Because if they want all these changes, of course, we know election reform is likely going to be blocked by Governor Tony Evers, because he does not want anything enacted into law that he believes would make it harder for people to vote. So sticking on elections, Jesse, I want to also bring up another election informal hearing that we've seen many times in the Assembly Elections Committee. So this week we had True the Vote, who testified to lawmakers that they were claiming proof of what's called ballot stuffing, or also ballot harvesting. That's basically what happens when groups gather people's absentee ballots and put them into ballot drop boxes on the behalf of another voter. So they had this presentation that said they gathered claiming cell phone data that they've tracked people multiple times near absentee ballot drop boxes. So this is a group, a right-wing group, I should say, that has also made very similar claims in Georgia as well. Nothing really resulted from that. So WEC kind of kind of disputed, I guess, their claim, saying, you know, data allegedly showing these cell phones that were tracked multiple times near absentee ballot drop boxes alone is not evidence of a crime. But there's kind of this gray area right now, especially after the Waukesha County judge's ruling, right? He banned, you can't use drop boxes besides the one at the clerk's office, and no one else besides yourself can drop off your ballot. So I guess here we are again with more groups kind of claiming this evidence, but not really further explaining it. They didn't show additional data. They didn't show any video. It's kind of this ongoing trend that we're seeing in Branch's hearing of trying to find what they claim is proof of fraud.
Right, and I think one point that the Elections Commission brought up and others brought up is that a lot of these ballot drop boxes are located in central locations and busy locations, and so you might have someone walking by having their cell phone ping multiple times in an area near that drop box, and you know that's just one possible justification for some of the pings that they're seeing there.
Yeah. Let's take a listen to Democrats kind of questioning this group and True the Vote that is kind of defending that, hey, we're not claiming evidence of fraud, but we think there was something illegal here. Let's take a listen.
You are not alleging that the ballots that were cast were illegal ballots. So, in other words, these may well have been ballots that voters themselves legally requested, legally filled out, sealed in an envelope, and then somebody else may have returned those ballots to a drop box on their behalf. You don't think that that process should have happened, but you're not alleging that the votes were actually illegal or that any particular voter voted more than once or voted when they weren't eligible to do so.
We've seen incidents where people are required to hand over open ballots. We've seen people that, just as you described, vote it and people are coming to pick it up. So there's sort of all manner of things. But I understand what you're getting at. And no, we're not saying that all of these ballots are illegal. What we are saying, though, is that they are being exploited, and we believe that's tantamount to abuse.
Jesse, what we also heard in that hearing is from Democratic Representative Lisa Subak from Madison. She was questioning True the Vote, the founder, that, you know, if you have all this evidence, why not refer it to law enforcement? And that's just something we haven't seen with a lot of individuals having these claims and showing what they say is proof, not really taking the next step, or they're being blocked at those next steps. Kind of the biggest headline, though, Jesse, that came out of this hearing came at the very end with attorney James Bopp, who is Michael Gableman's attorney. He represents him in many legal challenges to his subpoenas. He said he basically urged lawmakers to stop calling to decertify the 2020 election, calling it pointless. This was kind of a big statement because Gableman, just 3 weeks ago, was testifying to the same committee and said, you know, hey, lawmakers, you should take a really hard look at decertification.
Yeah, I mean,
it's very...
it's an interesting contradiction
dynamic.
There. And certainly, you know, from at least Republican lawmakers and leadership, they're really on that side of Bob of saying, let's just move on. You know, it is pointless. And I think even Gableman said it wouldn't change the outcome, but he still thought it was worth, again, a hard look at whatever, you know, that right. that would end up with. Yeah.
Do you think in a sense, you know, because Bob also kind of left open the door of almost in a sense kind of talking through a pathway of decertification, like you guys are a little too late. There's no electors to decertify, but, you know, we kind of left that door open where, in a sense, does this mean that what if, you know, happens down the road that this could maybe happen in Wisconsin?
I mean, I think that's the thing to wonder about. It's not so much going back to 2020. It's asking what happens in 2022 and what happens in 2024, and are they trying to lay out the argument and the pathway for that?
And we also like to tell people, too, that rescinding Wisconsin's 10 electoral votes has been told by nonpartisan legislative attorneys, a conservative law firm, and GOP leaders, all saying that it is legally impossible. So here we are again, seeing one group of people still really wanting this, and some Republicans kind of trying to stand up, same with Bob, saying it's time to move on. Speaking of moving on, let's move on to the next topic. So this was kind of exciting. Last week, we kind of teased this, that the Milwaukee was one of two finalists to go to, I guess, make their pitch to host the Republican National Convention. So this week, top leaders from Milwaukee and Nashville met with the Republican National Committee site selection panel in Washington, D.C. So Milwaukee, of course, is trying to vie for another chance to land the bid after hosting a nearly all virtual and what I like to say for reporters, kind of a disappointing Democratic National Convention in 2020. A lot of us were very excited to go cover that. But, you know, Republican or Democrat or convention, people are rallying behind this. They want to see this. I spoke to interim Milwaukee Mayor Johnson. He was in the room making that pitch. Let's hear a little bit about what he said, how that meeting went.
Told the members of the Republican National Committee that they're going to have a safe and successful convention here, that they would have the full support of my administration as mayor, and that we're going to pull out all the stops to make sure they have a successful convention that brings, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of economic impact to Milwaukee, helps us to put money in the pockets of our businesses as well as our residents in the city, and I'm excited about it. It's a competitive process, and there's still, you know, another city that is competing for the convention as well, but I think that our chances of landing the convention are really, really good.
So we just saw Acting Mayor Johnson say that he was pretty confident that they're going to land this bid. I guess for you, that, you know, we've been covering politics for a while now, what do you think Milwaukee has to offer compared to Nashville?
You know, it's in a battleground state, first of all, which is huge. And it's a great city, right? I mean, there's that just to, on its own. All of the selling points, all of the reasons why it was a good idea for the DNC to come to Milwaukee, apply to the RNC. And I think for the RNC, there's this sort of extra win of they really liked to kind of make fun of that virtual convention. You know, Republicans at the time were starting to move back to in-person events, and the DNC had promised Milwaukee and really didn't deliver on it.
Right.
You know, it was kind of all of the stress and all of the planning and none of the benefit from it. So for the RNC to be able to come in and say, look, the DNC didn't deliver here, but we did. I mean, that's not nothing.
Right. And they're trying to equip themselves that, hey, we're better because we had all the security measures in place. We know we have the hotels. We have the event venue. They have the Pfizer Forum. Also the Wisconsin Center with its renovation and expansion, I should say. So, you know, they're really trying to sell it. It's just a matter of what will happen because we know Tennessee is a red state. Nashville itself is, you know, kind of blue, I guess, the city itself. So I talked to UW-Madison political science professor Mike Wagner, who said, you know, yes, hospitality and security are important selling points, but he believes the political landscape, and I think we can agree, in Wisconsin, there is so much more at stake come 2024.
Absolutely.
All right. Last topic we want to talk about is not to scare people, but a lot of health officials are kind of putting some warning signs out there as they are monitoring the rise in cases that is attributed to what's called the stealth variant of the Omicron strain. So Milwaukee itself recorded a slight uptick in cases through wastewater surveillance. So health experts say, you know, while this recent surge may provide a short-term immunity along with vaccination, that it could kind of blunt the impact of the spread. But it's just really, once again, we're kind of in this uncertain time. DHS all this week also kind of put out an announcement that said, you know, we're really encouraging people to take precautions before, during, and after spring break travels. It's almost a little deja vu in a sense where the past two spring breaks have been disrupted by COVID. Some people didn't even get to have that. A lot of people were looking forward to going. So they're just kind of saying, you know, maybe if you're going out, your large crowds, maybe still wear a mask, especially if you're not vaccinated. That's what health officials have been telling us. Let's just hear a little bit from Dr. Ben Weston, who is a health leader in Milwaukee County, kind of talk about what this recent surge really means.
We talked last week about wastewater surveillance and possible increases that were being seen locally. And as we discussed then, it does seem that this was more a factor of variability among small numbers than a true trend, as that increase has largely dissipated. Wastewater will remain a critical tool to monitor the pandemic, particularly in times like right now when community testing is very low. So in the coming weeks, we may well see an increase in cases, hopefully a relatively small one, or we may merely see a slowing in our downtrend of cases. But one way or another, looking to the future, this is not the last variant that we'll see. We don't know what the next iteration of COVID will look like, but what we do know is that the best way for us as a community to be future-proof in the face of new variants is to increase our vaccination and booster rates.
So one really big tool that a lot of health officials are looking at now is what's called wastewater surveillance, because it's a really important tool to monitor how the virus is spreading in communities, because a lot of people are not going to community testing sites. We all are getting those federal testing kits maybe shipped to our house, or I can just go to a CVS and do it. So, you know, that's really why they're really paying a close attention to this. So I think in the next few weeks, we're going to see. They're not trying to freak people out, but it's once again another reminder, right, this pandemic is not over. I think the good news that came out this week is that Moderna also wants the FDA to authorize a COVID-19 vaccine for kids under six. So once again, here we are, more updates, maybe a potential surge, but I think the full reminder is if you're vaccinated, if you're doing the right things, I think you'll be okay. Maybe let's just hope not get to a dark, dark place, right, Jesse?
Yeah, we've just when we think we're getting over the hump, it gets a little nerve-wracking again. But as you said, you know, this is another tool for tracking. It's possible that this is just bringing to light information that has been there that we just didn't know was there.
And I think one thing that popped into my head is the whole mask debate. Mm-hmm. I think we know the governor cannot use his executive powers. Mm-hmm. The state health department cannot use their powers to issue a statewide mask mandate. No one really has one across the
state. Yeah,
and it was mainly Milwaukee and Madison that had the most strict mask policies in place. But, I mean, do you think it's possible that we go back to putting those on and we can maybe see more county mask mandates?
I mean, I think the more times we have to do it, the harder it is going to be to get people on board and to enforce. Unfortunately, it would probably take something a lot more serious, I think, to get that buy-in again. I mean, the fact that, you know, as you said, Dane County, Milwaukee County, Madison was such an outlier, it seemed like, compared to other parts of the state, or if you visited another state, the way that people still wore masks here by mandate. But also, it just seems like once that mandate was lifted, off they came.
You know,
people were really, really ready for that. But, you know, will we see maybe cities implementing it for, you know, public employees, or will it come up in schools again? I mean, that's all up for debate. As you mentioned, there's not really much that the governor can do about it. And we're certainly not going to see, I think, you know, any legislation we've seen introduced from Republicans who control the legislature has gone in the direction of not enforcing requirements,
anything.
You know, whether it's a mask mandate or a vaccine mandate or, you know, anything along those lines.
Yeah, I think what's also could be a possibility, very uncertain, is will masks go back in schools? That, of course, we know the virus kind of spreads, especially kids under six who can't get, you know, a vaccine. They can spread it more quickly. They could bring it home, those type of things. So that could be a potential down the road. But when I think of that too, Jesse, is, you know, I think a few weeks ago, me and JR touched on how I think COVID is kind of in the rearview mirror for Road to 2022, you know, August, the primary, and then November. But if things do maybe take a turn, I think we could see this being a big talking point again on the campaign trail.
Yeah, and it could have a significant effect on how people campaign and, you know, whether we are still doing virtual events or, you know, what kind of advantages and disadvantages the parties have on that. It's, you know, certainly been the case that Republicans have been more inclined to hold in-person events throughout the spread of the coronavirus, and Democrats have, as we mentioned during the DNC conversation, really reined it in a lot. And so if we see the sort of imbalance on that, that could always be an issue too.
Yeah, I think it'll be also something to keep an eye out for if people really start hitting Governor Evers once again for all of his mask mandates. I mean, that was so many, it was so long ago, I want to say, all those Supreme Court rulings and whatnot. But that was a kind of a big thing that we saw in other races. But
and we have Rebecca Clayfish has talked about that quite a bit already on the trail, talking about masks in schools and keeping kids at home. And you know, she's still making that an issue. Going into 2022.
In a sense, they're kind of tying that too with the critical race issue too, parents having more say, overall just having more control over what your child is being taught and what the rules are at each school district, because a lot of schools on the local level, of course, are taking matters into their own hands. All right, so that will do it this week, Jesse. Thank you so much for joining us on this week of Rewind. Really appreciate it. All right,
thanks.
That will do it. I'm Emily Fannin.
I'm Jesse Opoyan.
We'll see you next week.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.